Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite the potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of the morning show is a brand new interview about a brand new memoir about one of America's finest sportscasters. We'll have two interesting sports-related interviews out of the archives to balance out the hour of today's morning show. Stay tuned. We spend this portion of the morning show talking about the life of one of the finest sportscasters in the country, Al Michaels. We're talking with L. John Wertheim from Sports Illustrated, who is the collaborator with Al Michaels on this memoir called You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. I spoke with L. John Wertheim most recently about his marvelous book, Strokes of Genius, which followed the twin paths of two of tennis's greatest geniuses, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Again, this book by Al Michaels, You Can't Make This Up. L. John Wertheim, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you.
So can you say a quick word about how you exactly collaborated with Al Michaels on this memoir? I mean, who wrote what, or how did you work together?
It's a good question. I'd never done a book like this before, where it's a collaboration, and yet you want to capture the voice of the subject, in this case, Al Michaels. So basically, we did a lot of talking and a lot of conversation. Al, you can imagine, very easy guy to talk to, has this wealth of stories, and then it basically was my job to structure this in book form. So I've had colleagues who have written books like this with athletes, and they've said, oh, you know, this guy's 23 years old, and it's hard to get him to talk, and how am I going to get a book out of this? He hasn't done enough living. That was not an issue I faced. This was a lot of fun. This was probably a case of having so much material and editing and pairing rather than stretching words.
I imagine, given who you are and the work that you do, that to some extent, you already knew Al Michaels. How well did you know him before this project began?
Yeah, honestly, not that. I mean, we were acquaintances, and I mean, kind of person you'd run into at a game every now and then and say hi. But you know, we weren't, you know, close friends or anything like that. And I think in a way that sort of helped. That I certainly knew Al Michaels, but I didn't know chapter and verse, and he knew me, but not, you know, again, with assumption that we had a ton of overlap, and so it allowed us to sort of start fresh. And it was a much different exercise from a process standpoint than any other book I had written. But it was great. Really, I think we were both real happy with how it worked out.
I think one of the things that I especially appreciate about the book is that, in addition to hearing all kinds of really incredible stories about the Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid in 1980 and other memorable moments, we learn a lot about how the world of sports and sports on television has changed so drastically over the years. And one of the themes which comes up very often in the early part of the book is how Al Michaels came to prominence at a time which seems now so antiquated in terms of technology. And some of what he and his colleagues were forced to accomplish was especially difficult given the technological limitations of the day. Can you maybe talk about one or two examples of what I'm talking about? I think it's a very, very interesting part of this story.
No, I mean, first, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I think the best biographies and autobiographies have some deeper theme than just this compendium of stories and anecdotes, so I appreciate that. And yeah, that was something we tried to stress, that sports media has really changed a lot. Some of it's technology, some of it is just sort of our appetite, some of it's the money, and Al's been there the whole time. But you listen to some of his stories in the early going, whether it's, you know, the minor league baseball games or even, you know, the Miracle on Ice game was on tape delay. I mean, people remember that game, and it wasn't even live. The outcome had already been decided. I mean, imagine that today. An event of that magnitude, U.S., Soviet, this underdog team, the Olympics. Imagine viewers not getting that in real time and not knowing the result, whether it was through Twitter or the crawl at the bottom of the screen or some other form of social media, when they tuned in. And, you know, some of this is just transmission. Some of this is, you know, ESPN did not exist when Al started his career. It's funny because as much as sports has changed and, you know, whoever thought we'd have devices in our pockets that would double as phones and cameras and ways to watch clips when we're on airplanes, Al would also tell you that what he ultimately does for a job hasn't changed a whole lot in 40 years, that the distribution has and the method has and the speed has, but basically his job on Sunday nights isn't a whole lot different than what it was when his career was starting in the late 60s.
Hmm. I also appreciate how Al Michaels obviously has a marvelous grasp by now of how the work that he does has to vary from sport to sport, and not just because you're talking about a different sport, but with its own particular rules and so on, but that also pacing and rhythm and nuance is so different sport to sport. It specifically comes up at one point when he's talking about Ken Dryden, who was his broadcasting partner for that Miracle on Ice occasion, but he mentions in passing about, for instance, the drastic difference between being an on-air analyst during a hockey game versus during a football game. And it's not just that the rules of the game are different because the games are different, but the tools at your disposal and the means by which you're going to offer analysis, it's a completely different thing.
You know, that's a completely different thing. And the other thing that really struck me doing this book is that Al, we just started to count them up, and Al's had more than 100 partners. And what he has to do to work in conjunction with, you know, John Madden is totally different than what it is when he's working with, you know, just pick a name, Dennis Miller or Eric Dickerson or Bruce Jenner. And I think that there's a lot of versatility in games, and I think you're right. I mean, the rhythms and the cadences and sort of knowing when to let the action go. I mean, calling a baseball game is much different than calling a basketball game or calling a football game. But I also think Al has a real versatility in working alongside so many different people at so many different points in their career. Some of them were just novices, you know, Tommy Lasorda, who was managing 48 hours ago and suddenly is in the booth, versus working alongside a guy like John Madden is a totally different exercise. And I think that Al's versatility also extends to how well he adapts to his partners.
Absolutely. Something else he talks about one point, and maybe it's because I'm also a voice teacher, it kind of grabbed my attention when he said this, is he mentions at one point continuously working, and particularly as a young announcer, on perfecting on how to use his voice as an instrument, wanting to match the crowd. You don't want to be shouting while the crowd is quiet. You don't want to be whispering when the crowd is screaming. I always want to be in sync with the action. That's the kind of rather subtle, basic point that nevertheless I think is probably lost on the rest of us. But what a huge difference it makes if you aren't sensitive to something like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think not unlike being a referee, being a sports announcer is one of those jobs that, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone. We all sit at home and you say, I could do that. Or how come he's not mentioning the penalty that they got in the first half? And it's one of these games, it's one of these jobs that invites second guessing, and we all love and are passionate about sports, and it's one of these things that I think a lot of people say, I could do that. There's a lot that goes into it, and some of it is in the preparation and the getting the pronunciation of names right, but a lot of it is more nuanced. And that passage you write, the passage you just read, I think really illustrates that. There's a lot that goes on that these guys think about, and there's also a lot that they don't think about that just after so many years hopefully comes naturally.
Right, and he says at one point, on television, often less is more. I want to finish by mentioning that I think Al Michaels in this book does a wonderful job of speaking honestly and frankly and perceptively about the wide range of people with whom he's worked, some of whom he's not particularly fond of, and he's open about their faults, and yet this book also feels relatively kind and relatively respectful. And that seems like a tricky balancing act. I mean, he could be very cautious about other people's feelings, and the book would end up being pretty bland. And on the other hand, he seems like a nice enough person that does not go out of his way to be unkind about other people and their weaknesses and foibles and flaws. Could you just say a word about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that also is sort of that's who he is. I mean, I think his instinct is to like people and give them the benefit of the doubt. I think most people he's worked with, he's liked, and vice versa, but not everyone. And I think he knew for this book to be authentic, he didn't have to settle old scores, and he didn't have to bury people. But, you know, when someone, Boomer Esiason, to pick a name, when there were people that he didn't particularly care for, that wasn't something that he was gonna conceal. So, no, I mean, I think some people have read it, and they've sort of said, you know, I wish it were more of a tell-all, and doesn't Al dislike more people, and... I don't think that's the case, but also, as you say, it can't all be rainbows and balloons.
No, so we hear some frank talk about Rune Arledge and Howard Cosell and Pete Rose and many other fascinating people with whom he's worked or covered in this amazing career. The book, again, is You Can't Make This Up. L. John Wertheim, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. That was fun.
And it's exactly 8:22, and you are listening to The Morning Show on this Monday morning on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is an interesting sports-related morning show interview from the archives, which has to do with one of the biggest sports stars before the public today, written by one of our finest sports writers. Once again, I have the great pleasure to speak with one of America's finest writers, Buzz Bissinger. And I'm sure you know well the name Friday Night Lights. He is the author of that bestseller. And I had the pleasure of speaking with him about another great book, Three Nights in August, which focused on baseball manager Tony La Russa. From football to baseball, now to basketball, and to a marvelous book, which you have perhaps heard something about. It's called Shooting Stars, and it is a book which Buzz Bissinger crafted with one of the greatest basketball players on the planet, LeBron James. And it tells the very interesting, ultimately inspiring story of LeBron James's rise to basketball greatness through the high school years. An unlikely story it is. And it's a book not only about LeBron James, but his four teammates who together were known as the Fab Five. And this new book, Shooting Stars, is published by Penguin Press. And I'm very grateful to Buzz Bissinger for making time in his schedule to join us again on The Morning Show. Buzz Bissinger, we welcome you back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
It's great to talk about LeBron James. But one of the first things I want to ask you about is exactly how a book like this takes shape. Where the first name is LeBron James, but we know that you have to be responsible in large measure for the specifics of how this story is told. Can you talk for a moment about how your collaboration happened?
Well, you know, it's like many good things in life. A lot of it was serendipity and luck. We happen to share the same book agent in common, and this idea was LeBron's, which really, really impressed me, and an agent there, when he heard about the idea, said, well, we think we have the perfect guy because he's written extensively about high school sports and high school football, and that's his name is Buzz Bissinger, and he's written Friday Night Lights, and the agent put the two of us together, and I went out to LeBron's home in Akron, and we got along well, and the more he described the story, the more I liked it because of its all the different hues of it. It's complex, it's inspirational, it has dark moments, it has light moments, but it's really a book about the power of dreams and the power of enduring friendship. And those are two pretty great values in life.
And one of the things that impresses me is that to such an extent, it's a selfless project in that, I mean, LeBron James could so easily write a book primarily about LeBron James, it would fly off the shelves. But instead, he wants this book to be as much about the other four members of this basketball quintet as it is about him.
Well, I think that says a lot about LeBron. I mean, the one thing I want to make clear is this was never, ever intended to be an autobiography. This was never intended to be a complete kiss and tell about LeBron's life. And frankly, no autobiography is ever a complete kiss and tell about someone's life. I mean, you know, in the Ted Kennedy autobiography, I don't think he goes into much detail about what really happened that night in Chappaquiddick. What this was intended to be was just a great human interest story and a way of LeBron paying homage to the people in his life, the teammates he met when he was very young, and the role models that he was lucky enough to have, and to really say thank you. And folks, if you want to know how I became the kind of man that I became, you know, here is why.
So now take us behind the scenes in the actual crafting of this book. Now that we know how the two of you sort of connected in the first place, what can you tell us about the nuts and bolts of this book taking shape? And I mean specifically the shaping of this story, the choosing of the words that we ultimately see on the page. How did that happen?
Well, you know, this book was a huge departure for me in that it's, look, this is LeBron's book. It's told in the first person. You know, every sentiment expressed is LeBron's. You try to replicate the voice as much as you possibly can, but, you know, I went about it, at least try to do it the way I've done other books. In other words, this, to me, was a book that involved not just simply turning on a tape recorder and listening to LeBron for 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 hours, but to do other reporting. So obviously, you want to talk to the teammates that he met, the other members of the so-called shooting stars, so to speak, the kids that he met when he was 9 and stayed with for the next 9 years of his life. You want to interview coaches. You want to interview family members. You want to do research. You want to look at old newspaper articles and archives. You want to look at film tapes. I mean, to me, you know, this is what makes the book, you know, resonant. You want to talk to people who were critical of LeBron and do as much reporting as you can. So that's how I went about it. And, you know, I wrote much of it. And in some cases, I was good at sticking to LeBron's voice. And in some cases, my voice is there because I think that's one of the reasons I was hired. But after you do it, what we did was LeBron and his agent and a key figure in the book, Coach Drew Joyce, we sat at LeBron's new house for about 9 hours going over it word by word by word to make sure that it conformed with what LeBron felt and wanted. And that's the way it should be in this type of book.
One of the things that I suspect was tricky is that for as good a person as LeBron James was and is, these years that are covered, the high school years, were tinged with controversy here and there. And it's interesting to me how you probably, as a fairly objective third party, perhaps see some of those controversies differently than LeBron James does. In terms of who was really responsible, I mean, how should the fault in a given situation be shared or balanced? And I wonder, again, because you want this to be LeBron James's book, my sense is that in many cases, the perspective we get on some of these matters is really the perspective of LeBron James, and maybe in some cases, too, his perspective then at the time versus maybe a better perspective that he has now in retrospect. Can you help us kind of sort all that out? And
well, you know what? It is his perspective, but you know what else? I agree with it. I mean, I think that we never place things in context. All we want to do in society is particularly the media and people in general, because of the age that we live in, we want to build people up, and then we take perverse enjoyment in tearing them down. The controversies that LeBron went through, he went through when he was in high school. And I don't care how mature you are still in high school. And there's also a certain amount of reality that sets in. As far as anyone knows, and maybe when LeBron is 60, it'll come out, he didn't take any payoffs from sneaker companies. He took no payoffs from anybody. I'm sure you're referring to this incident where his mother bought him a Hummer. Was it great judgment? No, it was bad judgment because it looked bad. You know, should a kid have a Hummer that costs $50,000 when the family has no net worth? Well, I guess the answer is no, except it's obvious why she got the loan. She got the loan from a car dealer, and it was checked out because her son happened to be worth tens, if not worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And it happens all the time. And if we don't like that, then let's get rid of capitalism. In the other controversy involving LeBron's acceptance of two throwaway jerseys, it was minor. He gave them back. He apologized, and the sanctioning body for sports in Ohio conducted one of the worst investigations that I've ever seen, did not get their facts right, did not care about getting their facts right, and it was a witch hunt at this point. And they tried to throw him out. And, you know, LeBron's not stupid. His mother's not stupid. The people around him aren't stupid. If they felt that LeBron had really done something nefarious, they never would have taken it to court. And they took it to court, and the judge said, this is absurd. And so I don't think he acted. I think, given that he has been in a fishbowl for 8 years of his life, a huge fishbowl, I think he has conducted himself with enormous dignity. And I don't blame high school athletes. You know, I blame adults. I blame people around them. I mean, I saw the same thing happen in Friday Night Lights, except the kids, some of the kids in Friday Night Lights couldn't handle the type of exposure that LeBron got. So it is his perspective, and if his perspective was different from mine, you know, that would be fine. But it actually was not.
Right. I guess that's kind of the crux of the matter, is that if you viewed some of these matters differently, you would have been in a very interesting sort of predicament as the author, in a sense, but in fact,
not really, no predicament, because as I said, I mean, you know, you go, I went into this book with the full knowledge it's his book. I mean, it is his book, and I have to accept that. And if I can't accept that, you know, then I should not have done it. But you know, that was late in the game, and I just have to accept that. And that can be one of the, you know, one of the gnawing pitfalls. But I didn't find, you know, through my reporting or through talking to other people, and, you know, I probably have read about, you know, close to 200,000 words that have been written about him, I didn't find anything that was, you know, particularly nefarious about his behavior. And no one else has found it either. And trust me, hundreds of people have been looking for it.
We're speaking with Buzz Bissinger about his new book, Shooting Stars, written in collaboration with the basketball superstar LeBron James. I was going to say basketball legend. I mean, maybe we need to use that word down the road a bit, but he is already certainly among the very, very best basketball players we have ever seen. The book is mostly about basketball, but certainly we are told at least a bit about LeBron James's early years and the difficult circumstances in which he grew up with his mom. One thing that is written at one point that I think is quite touching in talking about how little there was in the James household, but how much he knew his mom loved him. He said, for instance, when it came to things like there somehow being presents under the Christmas tree and so on, he said, so as scary as life was at times, as tough as it was, it only made me love my mom more. Whatever my mom could do or could not do, I knew that nobody was more important in her life than I was. You have no idea how much that means when you grow up without so many of the basic things you should have. You have no idea of the security it gives you, of how it makes you think, I can get through this. I can survive. Those are really wonderfully crafted words.
Well, you know, it's really a reflection of precisely what LeBron thinks. I've seen the two of them together. I've interviewed his mom. I've interviewed others about his mom. And, you know, the bottom line was she did go through hard times. They went through hard times together. There were moments when he was very young where she would not be home for a night or two. She was struggling to make ends meet, but no one ever doubted her love and devotion to him. And I think that gave him a certain stability. And then I think, then he had the luck of certain role models, you know, stepping in when Gloria, his mom, just couldn't handle things. In many ways, he's a remarkable young man. He's very mature. He doesn't complain. He reacts to pressure well, and he appreciates loyalty. It's what he appreciates above everything, and it resonates in the book. And in a way, his mom's loyalty to him and her desperation to do right by him, you know, really made a tremendous difference in his life, you know, in the absence of a father and really in the absence of any friends until he met these other members of the Shooting Stars when he was a young boy, when he was 8 and 9. And they made, I think, all the difference in his life. And I think they saved each other as they went through their youth years and through their high school years together. And that's really what the book is about.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the things she did also was selflessly giving up LeBron at certain points
right.
in his childhood, allowing others to care for him at moments in time when she felt like it was not possible for her to give him all that he needed. This quintet of young men is fascinating. And I realize now, if I look at myself in all honesty, that when I look at the cover of the book and I see these five young African-Americans hoisting this trophy above their heads, I realize that I am too quick, and probably a lot of people are too quick to think of them in one fell swoop as all with probably very, very similar stories and very, very similar kind of young men, the same way we might see five diminutive Soviet gymnasts and also
right. yeah.
jump to those kind of conclusions. In fact, these are five individuals, and each with a very, very distinct story. Just talk for a moment about how rich they are as individuals and how that in itself enriches this story.
Well, you know, you make a great point, because, I mean, that's what we were trying to do in the book. Is it's not about LeBron. LeBron is almost the narrator, in a sense. It's as much about the other characters in his life as it is about him, maybe even more so. And in particular, it's about the other members of the Shooting Stars, the so-called Fab Five that he lived with through high school. So you have, you know, little Drew Joyce, who is called Little for a reason. Everyone says he's too little to play basketball, but through sheer will and determination and feistiness, you know, makes himself into a great player. You have, you know, Sheehan Cotton, who's 6'2" and in sixth grade and is big, but is kind of uncoordinated. But as he gets older, he's the most militant of the group. He's the one who has the hardest adjustment to a basically all-white Catholic school. You know, he's the one who junior year lets the exposure go to his head the most and admits to, you know, cheating on tests and not doing his homework and just copying it from other students. And then, you know, growing up as a senior. You have Romeo Travis, who joins the group as a sophomore in high school and at the beginning is hated by everyone. It's just impossible to be with. He's angry because of his very rough upbringing. Never had a father like LeBron. Moved around all the time, and because of it is very surly and distrustful and suspicious. And then you have, you know, Willie McGee, who at the age, and I find this unimaginable, at the age of 8, because his father and mother are they're lovely people, but they're having serious drug problems, and he's growing up on the west side of Chicago in a very rough neighborhood. Willie's 21-year-old brother in college says, "Willie, you're going to come live with me. You're going to come move to Akron with me." And the responsibility placed upon Willie's brother Ilya was enormous. And what an enormous transition for Willie. And Willie is the most mature of the group and the quietest, but the most level-headed. And you're right. I mean, it's just great, distinct characters, you know, far beyond LeBron. And I think that's what this book tries to bring out, is that these other characters and how from such disparate roots, these kids come together in a way that is so powerful and ultimately beautiful, really like a love story.
Well, and for the rest of us who in no way have experienced any of this or don't come from a place like the rougher neighborhoods of Akron, Ohio, it's important for us to know that in a place like that, it's possible still to have these disparate backgrounds and disparate stories, to not think in broad generalities, and especially to not jump to conclusions about who someone is or how they're made up. And particularly, of course, we see that play out in basketball. Early, you write, basketball is about finding the right parts and putting them together. And that's ultimately what happens with this quintet. Tell us about the controversy that surrounded the decision of these young men to go to this Catholic high school versus one of the public schools in the city, how that was viewed by some people in the black community.
Well, there was an expectation. By the time they were in eighth grade, it was well known that, that these guys were really good basketball players, and LeBron in particular was a potentially superstar basketball player, but they all were good. There were only four of them at the time, since Romeo Travis didn't join the group until he was in high school, and the expectation was they would go to the predominantly black public high school in town called Buchtel, because it was an athletic powerhouse, and that's where all good black athletes from Akron generally went. But they had made a pact. They wanted to win a national championship. They had come close, very close in eighth grade when they played on an AAU team called the Shooting Stars, hence the title, and they just tasted that, and they wanted to taste the full glory of it, and they made that pact. And, you know, Buchtel was the place, but it was little Drew who said, I'm not going. They're not giving me a fair shot. They're judging me like everyone in life judges me, that I'm too small and I'm too this and I'm too that, and I don't like it, and I'm not going to accept it. And I know the coach over at St. Vincent St. Mary, which is a basically all-white Catholic school, and I'm going there. And they all looked at him and said, wait a sec, we're going to Buchtel. You know, what's the deal? He says, I don't care what the deal is, because little Drew, to me, in some ways, is the best character in the book. He's so feisty and so tough and so combative and so relentless. He says, I don't care. I'm not going. And so they went to a St. Vincent St. Mary. The black community in Akron was livid. They were up in arms. They felt these kids were traitors. They felt that little Drew's father, Drew Joyce, was a traitor because he had been on the Buchtel staff. And, you know, people said, you're a black man. Can't you control these kids? How can you have them going to the Catholic school in town? Shyam Cotton's father got the same type of grief. He said he was basically cast out of the black community. And, you know, so every game they played over the next 4 years, when they played a public high school in Akron, it was like a war. And then on top of that, there was terrible racism directed at them when they were seniors. Just, you know, they would go to other places in Ohio, and people would yell the N-word. And just, you know, it was like they were, Shyam Cotton says, we felt like we were in the movie Gladiators. It got so intense.
Hmm. You do such a great job of sort of describing what life was like in the trenches, and particularly as they take on increasing greatness as a team. One of the young men, Romeo, says this or expressed this. For Romeo, the favorite part of the game occurred before the start when he walked into the gym. Right away, he could tell what kind of team we were playing, the way some opponents turned their heads and would not look you in the eye, the way some others had that starry look as if they were saying, oh, my God, that's them, the way others tried to stare you down and act macho. But none of the poses mattered to Romeo or the rest of us, because we knew what was going to happen right at tip-off. We truly were invincible. Nobody could beat us. Although ultimately they tasted some defeat because of their cockiness, and this proved to be a valuable learning experience and helped forge the summit which they finally achieved as seniors.
Well, you know, that's another reason I did this book. I just loved the arc of it, because it's not all, you know, fun and games, and it's not all glory and greatness, and part of the book is to show to people, whether you're an adult, whether you're a teenager, whether you're a pre-teenager, because it's true in every walk of life, what can happen when success goes to your head? What can happen when, you know, you get so much exposure and pats on the back over something that you begin to believe it? And this is what happened with these kids. And you got to remember, they were still in high school. When LeBron got on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a junior, it was a frenzy. It became a national media frenzy, and it all went to their heads. And as Romeo says, they were convinced they were invincible. They were convinced they could stay up until 3 or 4 in the morning and then play a game the next day and not worry about their opponents. They felt like rock stars. They began to screw around in the classroom. They just forgot what their role was, not simply as athletes, but as kids going to school. They had no respect for their coach, who at that point was little Drew's father, Drew Joyce. They were arrogant. They were jerks, as LeBron said, and they, you know, without giving the whole book away, they really paid a price for it, and I think there's a lesson in there that everybody can learn from.
Hmm. When I mentioned the matter of controversy earlier in the interview, it's interesting, although you brought up a couple of the real headline items, and of course, ultimately, LeBron James was exonerated of I guess we could sort of say the charges that were sort of being conceived against him. But in some ways, what I meant almost most was the way in which LeBron James talks about the high school he attended, and how really, without too much sense of hesitation, he basically says rather matter-of-factly that we were there to play basketball. I mean, that's why they chose St. Vincent. That's why they were there. And through the pages of this book, we actually see very, very little about much of anything that happened with them off the court. I mean, you know, we don't hear anything about LeBron James's favorite teachers or favorite classes or whatever, and we get a sense that he's being very honest and, in a sense, courageously so in talking about his high school experience and the fact that for all five of them, they were there to play basketball. I mean, not that he didn't ultimately, you know, get some good grades and so on, and he was probably, in some ways, the most serious, diligent student of them. But I wonder if you could just talk a moment about that.
Well, you know, I just think that, I mean, having written Friday Night Lights, you know, I know what you're able to legitimately do as a writer and reporter and what you're not legitimately able to do. You know, it's one thing to be there and sort of observe kids in action in a classroom and see the interaction they have with teachers, and it's another thing to reconstruct it, because if you're trying to reconstruct it, no one's really going to tell you the truth anyway. And the fact of the matter is, their academic, and this was not a book about their academic days at St. Vincent, St. Mary. I don't think it would be particularly interesting. And the fact of the matter, as you point out, was they were all pretty blunt about why they were there. I mean, Little Drew says the same thing. You know, Romeo says the same thing. We were there to play basketball, but it's also pointed out that Little Drew was not a very good student and had academic difficulty. It's pointed out that Romeo, at the beginning, never went to school at all and only went because the school called and said, you're going to be academically ineligible. It's pointed out that, as I said before, you know, she and Cotton, you know, cheated on tests and tried to sneak out of the classroom and copied his homework from other students and was ultimately declared ineligible for the first five games of his football season. And he was a much better football player than basketball player. So the point is, there was no attempt to sugarcoat, you know, any of that stuff. And having seen both sides of the fence, I give St. Vincent St. Mary's a lot of credit. They never, ever, ever, Odessa Permian, when I wrote Friday Night Lights, never, ever would have declared a key football player ineligible for any part of the football season. It would not have happened. It would not have happened. And St. Vincent St. Mary did when they said that she and Cotton couldn't play, and he was arguably the best player on the team, and they said, no, you're not going to play. But as I say, I mean, you know, if I'd written extensively about their school days together, and maybe it was the wrong call, but LeBron and I felt it just really would not have been that interesting. And as you said, you know, basketball was their primary focus. There's no doubt about it.
Right. Oh, I have no argument with the choice made about, you know, what this book is about. I think it is an honest reflection of who they were and of what was important to them.
No, that's right. You're right. It's
yeah.
Very good point.
Yeah. And ultimately, not only does this end happily for them, but LeBron James, of course, has proven to be an exemplary citizen of Akron, Ohio. I mean, his connection to his community appears to be as powerful as it ever was.
Well, you know, I think that says a lot about LeBron, and it's resonant throughout the book. You brought up some wonderful points. You know, it's the loyalty he has to his mom, knowing that, look, she's doing the best for me she possibly can, and I know she's going through hard times, and I'm not going to add to those hard times by whining and complaining when we have to move. Loyalty, as I say, is so paramount to him, and he loves Akron because Akron saved him. I'm not sure, you know, had he grown up in Chicago or New York or Philadelphia or Boston or Atlanta, I think it would have been very different because Akron had very rough parts, but Akron was small enough so that, you know, once he got identified as a good athlete, people rallied around him, not just because he was a good athlete, but because he was a lost boy, and they wanted to save him. And I think that's why LeBron just built a new 40,000-square-foot house in Akron. That's why playing in Cleveland is so important to him, and that's why his love of Akron is real. And, you know, he does a tremendous amount for the community, and whether he goes somewhere else to play or not, he always will, because he loves Akron, and he loves Akron, as I say, because I think he really believes this place saved me from ending up in the streets.
Hmm. It's an amazing book. Again, it's called Shooting Stars. It's published by Penguin Press. And its two authors, LeBron James and my guest today, Buzz Bissinger. Buzz Bissinger, a great pleasure and honor again for me to speak with you today on the morning show. I did enjoy this so much. And
well,
thank you.
The questions were wonderful, as always. It's really wonderful to talk to someone who's prepared.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. That interview from the WGTT archives from some years ago, that interview was conducted before LeBron James made his somewhat controversial exit to the Miami Heat. And, of course, LeBron James recently has returned to the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's 9 minutes before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. To finish out today's music potpourri, we turn to a book by Mark Kreidler called Six Good Innings, How One Small Town Became a Little League Giant. In this fascinating book published by HarperCollins, Mark Kreidler follows the exploits of an extraordinarily successful Little League team in Toms River, New Jersey, a team which has achieved unprecedented success, especially when one considers how small the town is and the stunning success which it has enjoyed over the course of many, many years. Here's a portion of our conversation. Mark Kreidler, you mentioned at the top of the interview that you came to this very much as an insider, that is, as somebody who has coached Little League. Your own two sons play Little League. I forget if you said if you yourself played Little League once upon a time. When you came to Toms River, New Jersey, and began observing this young team and meeting the coach and the athletes and so on, how hard was it to remain simply an observer without sort of offering observations and suggestions and that? I mean, it seems like in just the course of normal conversation, it would have been really easy to do that. And maybe you allowed that to happen.
Well, I give myself a little bit of a little more latitude than I did when I was a straight sports writer, which was my previous life before I began writing books, in that I used to spend so much time covering college and professional sports, and, you know, a distance is not only useful, it's necessary. And it's necessary to be as objective as you can and I think for the most part to keep a little bit of a wall between yourself and most of your subjects. And it's more comfortable for them as well. Mm. With the first book that I did, 4 Days to Glory, when I spent so much time in the middle part of America, in Iowa, I think I was surprised to find that near the end of the story, as the young athletes who I was writing about, as their stories were reaching the end or nearing the end of their arc, I was sort of openly rooting. I mean, things had really changed, and I think I had to take stock of the fact that I wasn't just in detached, objective observer. And so I think going into Toms River, I had the idea that before it was all over, I would probably be hoping for good things to happen for the kids. And I think what I did try to do was actually hedge against that a little bit, keep a little bit of distance and try to, I actually got to know the kids and the families in much greater detail after the conclusion of their baseball season. I spent a lot of time getting to know them a little bit during the season. And after was when I think the friendships began to be formed as we got closer. So I allowed, because the beauty of reporting is that you can also go back in time. You can see it in real time, but you can also go back in time to revisit what you've seen.
Hmm. You don't say, I don't think, that any names are changed. Are these the real names, for instance, of these young athletes on this Little League team?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Did you think about changing their names or in any way thinking protectively about their privacy?
Well, I think I had to go into the project either one way or the other, and I think that's just the nature of writing. You're either going to write fiction or nonfiction. If it's nonfiction, it's purported to be real. It really happened. And only in the most extreme cases would you not use someone's real name or identity. Now, I understand what you're asking because these kids are 12. They're not, you know, they haven't chosen to be fully grown up adults.
Right.
And they're actually not at the age of consent, strictly speaking. And so I think I debated on that a little bit and realized that they were, by virtue of the fact that they were little leaguers, already known in Tom's River, certainly, and already having been written about a little bit, which is the nature of life in Tom's River in Little League. I think if you Google the Tom's River Little League in the New York Times system, you'll find something like 24 or 30 stories that the New York Times has written over the years about Tom's River baseball. So I think that I had a working concept that if I was going to write truly and honestly, that it needed to be about real people that anyone could see was living an actual life.
Well, and honestly, if you're going to play Little League baseball in Toms Rivers, New Jersey, then you better not be very much interested in anonymity.
all bets are off.
It's a very public exploit in a town like that. That's
but listen,
for sure.
I had the same thought, and I really actually kind of thought about it from my own perspective. I have now a 14-year-old son and a 10-year-old son. When my 14 was 12, he was in Little League All-Stars. My 10-year-old has been in Little League All-Stars for the last couple of years. If someone approached me and said, we're going to write about your son and his name's going to be in the paper, my first instinct, even though I've spent my career in print journalism, would be to say, absolutely not. You're not writing about my son. I don't want his name in the paper at that age. And so I had to sort of balance that thought as I went through this, and I was very sensitive to the families in that I felt really, I took an extraordinary amount of time to explain to them how books work. Because I think it's one thing to say, yeah, oh yes, I'll sit and talk to you about this. This will be fun. And it's another thing when that resulting product lands on your neighbor's coffee table and it's in print and it's not changing. You know, so my responsibility is I have only one chance to get it right.
I'm struck by the fact that as we read about particularly the really central players on this team, players like Scotty and Johnny, the coach's son, and Chris, one of the pitchers and so on, we get done reading about them and they all seem like nice guys. And good kids, and I mean, we just don't see much that dissuades us from that opinion of them. And I'm wondering, is that because they just are really good kids, and there isn't much dark side to them, or is it that the dark side was sort of beside the point, or did you go out of your way to protect them in that respect, at least, by not writing about those moments when kids become self-centered or prima donnas or unkind to one another? I mean, did you honestly just not see that play out very much on this team?
There was actually a certain sort of blandness to the kids on the team, I should, in part because it isn't as though their personalities aren't forming. There are a couple of kids who I mentioned in the book several times, Vinny Ignatowicz is one, who's funny, upbeat, and just a constant chatterbox. Not in a negative way, but his personality is already beginning to take shape. You know, he's going to be the kid who talks his way through every situation. And there are some other kids like Johnny and certainly like Scotty Ringel, who is of their group, he's the kid who seemed to have hit his adolescence first, is taller than the others and very quiet. And so his personality is beginning to assert as well. But in terms of the more overt stuff that you look for, that every parent looks for, I didn't find a lot of it. And I think part of it is the Toms River community in general, and I lay this out in the book, for one thing is, There is a certain homogenous quality to it. It's about 95% white, first of all. It's very solidly middle class. The crime rate's very low. Not a lot happens. And so they are